Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that dares you to think outside the box of convention. And we are doing that wonderfully, considering all of the things that are transpiring in our worldly scene. So hold on a second, because we've got some technological stuff happening. And there, I fixed that. All righty, this is Patricia Corey, your host. We are trying to get out my guest William Henry on the line today. He's in a hotel, so the hotel is giving us, "We reached the number that you have reached. We'll now dial you," to that kind of thing. So we're trying to get William on the phone, and we should have him in short order. In the meantime, before I get rolling with William, I would like to launch a message to Denise. I know you're listening. And I want you to know that there are many, many people praying for you, sending you healing, sending you light and love. And the message to you is, don't give up, girl. Stand tall, be strong, and know that even in the darkest hour, there is love all around you, okay? And I'm counting on you, so you come through for me. For you first, and for all of us second, all right? All righty, well. So much to share. Wow, and it's been such an amazing week. Last week, obviously the show today is about Egypt. Last week, we watched as the protesters stood their ground, stood in their dignity, stood against violence, stood against power, suffering and all of it, because they've had enough. And today, yesterday we had the great news that Mubarak finally went. And now there's a lot of justifiable debate about what does this mean. Is it really a great revolution for Egypt? Is it the beginning of another system that would be worse, like the Muslim? Well, I'm not saying it's worse, but many theories about what's coming down in Egypt. But we're going to talk about all of those today. We've got William now. And I want to just announce that William Henry and I had talked about being together in Egypt. His group was earlier than mine, so we couldn't work it out. His group went and was stuck and caught right in the middle of it, and I'm sure that he'll correct me and say we weren't stuck, Patricia. We were living in an experience that was memorable and powerful, maybe they were stuck trying to get out, though. I mean, let's be honest. But at any rate, we will talk about what it all means to the planet, to the Egyptians, to the region, and William's personal experience with his new wife, Claire. It's going to be a full show, so thank you for tuning in. And thank you, William. It's nice we finally got through to you.
Yeah, hi, Patricia. How are you?
We're great. Thank you. I want to say that it was almost harder to get through to you here in the States than it was to get through to you in Egypt.
Oh, no.
But thank you for coming on. As you know, I asked you to come on in short order, so I preempted my guest, Nick Redfern, who was generously kind enough to postpone so that we could get a relatively first-hand story from you of all you've been through and talk about what's happened.
I'm sorry, I've got an emergency call. Just one moment, okay?
Okie doke.
Hello?
Yeah, this is interesting, isn't it, folks? Conducting radio by phone. It is a tall order. All right, well, while we're waiting for William, of course, I'm sure many of you know who he is, a wonderful spirit leader. We have similar things in common. He does spirit groups like I do. He is, but really, a scholarly spiritual man with much wisdom. And his site is williamhenry.com. So once we get him back on, are you back? Are you back, William? Uh-oh, I hope it's not a really bad emergency. So you might want to take a look at his website and see all the great things that he's into. And like I was saying, we have a lot of similar things in common. We both bring people on quest experiences. Oh, we've lost him again. Okay, well, let's see. We're going to do this show by hook or by crook. So please, producers, let's get him back, and we'll try to move forward. At any rate, there is quite a buzz as to the events that have delineated the days that have passed. I was supposed to be in Egypt in these days, and we had to cancel my group because at the time that we were supposed to be there, getting ready to go there, it was right in the middle of all the events that were happening at Tahrir Square, and I just couldn't justify. Not only could I not justify taking people, but we couldn't get people in if we wanted to. It would have been extremely bad judgment. So we sat and watched as the Egyptian people stood for their freedom. And I have to say that it was a grippingly emotional experience for me personally because I so love Egypt, as I'm sure many of you do. And I go there quite a lot. I have people there. It was so difficult not knowing what was happening. And yet, despite the fear, despite the concern and the violence that we witnessed, there was an underwriting dignity in the experience. There was power in these people. There was truth. There was light. There was an explosive human outcry. And I am known to say this expression over and over again, never underestimate the power of the human spirit. And we certainly saw that in Egypt in these days. So we have now Mubarak is gone. We have a replacement which people claim could be worse, but I don't really think this Suleiman guy is here to stay. I think he's an interim, probably another despot. But I wouldn't want to. Let me ask you this. Would you like to be a despotic leader in Egypt at the moment? So even though we've got quite a buzz going on in all our social networks about how very possibly the Egypts are going to go backward, not forward, I don't believe that. I can't believe it. I really want to believe and feel in my heart that if they got rid of one despot, they can get rid of many more. And that this may very well be a great awakening in Egypt and in the entire region. And that is what we need to focus on instead of immediately jumping to the conclusion, well, great, now we got rid of this guy, and now we're going to have a worse situation. Hold on, I've got a message coming in. I have to thank all of you who listen to my show regularly for being so patient, because we really do struggle so many times with making these links work. And God, I would really love to be in a studio and have all the professionalism of being in a studio with all the technology around me. But unfortunately, that is not doable at the moment for reasons that are obvious. And also because I would still need if I were doing call-in guests, there would still be this problem of the lines dropping and whatever. So, what is happening? Well, it might be a good time to get a dialogue going until we can get him back. And I always implore you people to call, but why are you so shy? Let's talk about this. Why are you so shy to call in and talk to me when I ask for call-ins? Because we're doing this together. This is our experience. These are our feelings. And if you think you're shy, try doing this hour after hour. So why don't you call in? Let's get a dialogue going because I'm not sure we're going to get William back. I hope there's nothing really grave happening. My call-in line is 888-815-9756. And that's toll-free in the U.S. and Canada. And I'd like you to call in now because we have a lot of feelings, we have a lot of opinions about the future of Egypt. So won't you call in and share with me and share with others how you perceive what is happening now, what's coming down? How do you perceive what is going to happen next? And I'd like to talk about Egypt as our global heritage. I'm concerned about, for example, the antiquities. Let's not suggest that I'm not concerned about the people, but I see plunder as a natural byproduct in any kind of revolutionary experience, as we saw in Iraq and so many other places. And I'm concerned about the relics, and we saw what happened. What happened at the museum when they broke in, and fortunately, not that much damage was done, although somebody walked off with one of the incredible neck beads, beaded works of King Tut, not to mention statues that were made of wood that were broken in half. That was heartbreaking. So let's hope that the military or whoever is going to be getting people through this transition have got an idea of how to protect those unimaginable archaeological wealth that is Egypt. Because in times of rage and destruction, those things, unfortunately, these ancient wonders that have stood 10,000, 5,000 years, can be blown away in an instant. And that is something I'd like to address. Okay, where are you, shy people? Nobody's calling, so I guess I'll just have to talk all by myself. What to do? Okay, we've got the producer saying we're trying to get back through to William. Well, that's a bummer. I mean, it took such a miracle to get him to come on in such short notice. All right, hold on. Here he is. Have we got him back?
Patricia?
Oh, my God, William, what's happening?
I am so sorry about that. That's never happened before, and I really apologize.
That's okay. We're really glad to have you back, because I was starting to sound like okay, guys, like I was 12 years old and didn't know what to say at school.
I know. I really, really apologize. I mean, this sounds really kind of trite and just stupid, but a very, very, very famous actor told me he was going to call me earlier this morning. And I thought, okay, this is going to be great, because then Patricia will be calling, and it'll be just perfect timing. And it was really important that I talk with them. And he called right then. So I really apologize. I shouldn't have done that, but I hope you'll forgive me.
I forgive you if you tell us who the famous actor is.
Oh, boy. he played Charlie Chaplin. He plays Iron Man. He is, I think, one of the most talented and gifted individuals.
Oh, wow.
On the planet. Yeah.
Is he going to play you in an upcoming film or something?
But he is a huge fan of all the things that we're all about. That's his life, he says. It's all about this kind of research. He's got a glorified day job, he says, but he lives where we live. And I met him a few years ago when he was first doing Iron Man, and had some conversations with him about how he could, well, the term he used was William Henryize the character without changing the script, and we've just become friends. And so I'm in town, and we were setting something up, and I, you know, just had to take the call, so I apologize.
Well, that's okay. We feel honored that Robert Downey called in the middle of your interview. And you tell him, though.
And he'll get a big laugh about it later. He'll be mad that I did that. He said, you could have called me back or something like that. But, you know, I just get nervous.
No, you just tell him that we were glad it was important enough for you to speak. All right. Well, I tried to keep the ball rolling here. And I've been talking, just basically talking about the transition and my concerns. And of course, my concerns, all of our concerns. But I need to back up and let's talk about what you went through. Now, I kept pretty much up to date by your brief messages. So we knew that you were alive and well and holed up in the hotel for days.
Yes.
But can you give us a little bit deeper understanding of what transitioned and what happened before you actually were in pretty much lockdown at the hotel?
Yeah, sure. We of course, were doing a two-week tour, and we had... We got almost all the way through. We had just a couple of days left, but I guess our story for us really kind of started. We were flying from Cairo down to Aswan to pick up the boat, And we're in the brand new, just a beautiful new terminal there at the Cairo airport. And we're going along, we go through security, then we're going up to our gate, and we have to go through a second round of security. And as you know, the Egyptians are very protective of their tourists, very security conscious. And so we're standing there, and a few of us are kind of complaining that, oh, we have to go through security again. And there's a guy behind us, a British guy, who says, well, wait till you see what's going to happen in Egypt next week. And we're just standing there going, what are you talking about? And we brought it to the attention of our tour facilitators, and they just totally blew it off. It said it means nothing and all this kind of thing. But yet it bothered us because this guy seemed to have some kind of a clue that Egypt could be a nervous place the following week. Well, as it turns out, everything just kind of blew up in Egypt with the revolution. And in fact, we flew from Luxor back up to Cairo on that Wednesday. Thursday is when all the demonstrations start, and it's then that the curfew is imposed. The internet goes dark, no phones, and all of a sudden we're starting to feel like, well, wait a minute, maybe this isn't such a good thing here. Maybe there's a little bit an element of danger here. So, in fact, we go to sleep that night, and my wife and I are awoken by the sound outside. We didn't know what it was. We get up the next morning, and our hotel's surrounded by tanks.
And Are you kidding? I didn't know that there were tanks out at Giza.
We were staying at the Meridian Hotel, which is down the street from the famous Mena House, and there were half a dozen tanks out in front of our hotel, military all over the place. And we know for sure now that it's like a switch was flipped, Patricia. You go to sleep in one country, and everything is just fine, and you wake up like going through some kind of a dimensional shift or something, where all of a sudden you're in what potentially could be a very dangerous situation, certainly very serious, with huge implications. And so we did. We hunkered down in the hotel. We were told not to leave the hotel. People wanted to, go up to the Giza Plateau, but the pyramids had been closed, and we were warned against going out because we were fair game. There was no police. The police abandoned their posts.
Okay, now, let me back up a minute and let me ask you, what date are we talking about specifically when you woke up and it was dementia?
That would have been January 26th. The 25th was the day the demonstrations really started.
And then so that was before the big bloody revolutionary day.
Yeah, so 26th, 27th. It was when we came back up to Cairo on the day of the demonstrations that the curfews were imposed and everything changed virtually overnight.
Well, what do you make out of this guy that said, wait until you see what's happening? Did he look like a diplomat?
He looked like MI6 or something. He was a British guy, very diplomatic looking. It easily could be figured he'd be like an intelligence type or something. Now,
so there was nothing brewing at that point. So in other words,
the only thing that was brewing was the events in Tunisia of the week before.
Sure.
But I don't think anybody had any inclination whatsoever. I mean, they could have said, okay, we're going to have some demonstrations on Tuesday in Cairo. But I don't think anybody could have predicted or known the magnitude of the shift that was about to take place in Egypt and now is rippling around the world.
So let's go back then. That's a real bummer. How many days were you stuck in the hotel?
5 days.
Gasp.
Yep. And during that time, of course, our group goes through the whole kind of gamut of emotions. You realize you're in a crisis. People are starting to wonder, how are we going to get home? And you can't call anybody. You can't go online because they've killed the internet. It was coming on sporadically, 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there, maybe an hour there. And it just started to get really challenging because you're thinking, well, okay, what if we can catch a flight? Well, all of a sudden, you've got the news Delta has suspended all flights in and out of Egypt. British Airways isn't fulfilling all of their schedules. There's some European airlines that are taking people places, but we didn't have reservations on any of those airlines. And people are starting to wonder, including my wife and I, are we going to get out of here? Are we going to, is this where we end up? Are we going to stay here? because if we have to stay here, it's not going to be a pretty sight. Well, I mean, as you know, the Egyptians are fine with Europeans. They're fine with Americans. You could even say they love Europeans. They love Americans. But in a situation where everything's cut off, including food supply, our hotel was starting to run out of food, you're thinking, well, how many days do we really have here? Is this a situation where, well, in fact, we started rationing our food. We started stockpiling some water. We didn't know, and that was the biggest challenge and the scariest part of the whole ordeal was not knowing what was going to happen next. One night we go to sleep, we wake up, there's tanks outside. Go to sleep the next night, there's gunfire all around the hotel. Some gangs had broken into the police station near the pyramids, overrun it, and stole all the guns. Now you've got gunfire all night in the streets. And you're wondering, what's going to happen tomorrow? And how safe are we, really?
Well, yeah, because at the Hilton downtown, people were limited to the upper, they couldn't come below the fourth floor.
Wow.
And there were police and military, I think, in the hotel trying to secure the hotel. So it was, let's say, yes, the Egyptians do love foreigners and we love the Egyptians, but you don't know what's going to happen in a revolutionary environment.
There's a limit. Exactly. Exactly.
And then we got word that what had happened was that the police disappeared because they were now dressed in plain clothes and were releasing gangs of criminals from the jails. Did you get that information?
I heard that. I can't confirm that, but people were telling me, who do you think the gangs were? It was the police.
It was the police. They disappeared completely from the streets. And, of course, it makes sense if you think about it. What better way to distract the peaceful protests and the rising incremental energy of that protest than to freak people out with gangs of criminals out on the street breaking into homes? 60 women were raped in like 2 days.
I know. I heard horrific stories on the plane when we finally got out about women cut in half, lots of rapes going on, and just total brutality. Again, unconfirmed, but still, you can see how that could certainly be a possibility.
Women cut in half?
A woman was, this young Egyptian man, 20 years old, said he witnessed a woman cut in half.
Oh, my God.
I mean,
well, for people that are listening, I want you to understand that we're talking about criminals, very and bad people who were released from the jails and given carte blanche to just go to town. And that is why we started to see the Egyptians holding vigilante groups trying to protect their neighborhoods as best they could. So, you know, I announced that, as you recall, you and I had talked about joining our somehow together on this trip. And I was thinking so much of you when you were there, thinking, wow, I don't want to say there, but for the grace of God go I. But I had to make a decision because we were supposed to leave. And a few people in the group were saying, Patricia, why aren't we going? So what if there's a little trouble? I said, no, you don't get it. There's more than a little trouble going on.
Right.
And my contacts in Abydos, my brother Amir in Abydos, said, everything's fine here. Don't worry about it. And I was just like, okay, the Egyptians are trying to downplay the gravity of this situation, but there was no question that it was a very, very dangerous environment.
Yeah. And the key thing is, once again, nobody knew what was going to happen. Was the army going to turn on the people? If that happened, you've got civil war. No flights in and out. We're trapped in Egypt. Anybody coming in is not getting out. A lot of the airlines just simply turned their planes around because of the curfew, which was another huge factor. Every evening at afternoon at 4 p.m., there was a curfew imposed that lasted until 8 a.m. So people were trying to leave the country. Most of the flights, like the British Airways flight, was at 8:50 a.m. So you're either looking at spending the night 30 hours in the airport in Cairo, which was not advisable, according to the British embassy, or you're not going to get your flight. And so these were some of the complications that we started to experience. And we don't mean to sound like, you know, we're a bunch of whiners or something like that, but it was tough on people because you got a group of people, in my case, 24 of us, half of them had never left the country, the U.S. before, and didn't have a cell phone, were running low on cash, and just had no clue about what was going on. And our tour operator, Abercrombie and Kent, who came through and in Trump's force at the end, they kind of had a little hiccup because they, too, like every other Egyptian, had to obey that curfew. So, and they didn't have communications either. So we were basically, and they made an island out of us. Mubarak made an island out of us and everybody else. And, in fact, that was one of the key things, Patricia, that among the more the white-collar type Egyptians, that's one of the reasons why they turned on Mubarak. They were furious. How dare he cut the phones and cut the Internet? What if something happens to my child and I can't reach my wife, a couple of them were saying. That was the last straw for them, and that's when the revolution, I think, really took on an accelerated kind of movement, because it started out, we're told, by the young Facebook generation, the kids, if you will, but then you got the professionals in because he was threatening their livelihood, threatening their family, and now they were ready for blood themselves.
My gosh. So, obviously, this was a spiritual group, and you talked about going through so many different emotions. I can only imagine what it was like for you to be holed up in this hotel in beautiful Egypt, surrounded by tanks, which is a shocker to me. I didn't realize there were tanks out at Giza.
I didn't either. Where'd they come from, right?
I mean, Giza, as far as when I was still planning to come with my group, I was told that it was all at Tahrir Square and that Giza was off the map as far as it was all concerned. And then I saw a little map, and it showed a little arrow pointing to Giza. So I was like, okay, so Giza is also... And I worried about you because we were tracking you. We were trying to find out how your group was doing, and it was clear that you were in danger.
Yeah, well, we were, and I just... We had meetings, pep talks, if you will, keeping everybody focused on what we were going to do, taking it one step at a time, and trying to just build on the success and keep everybody just locked on to, hey, we're going to get home. We're going to get through this. We're going to celebrate. Focus on that. And, of course, the whole hero's journey concept became very helpful, where the idea is that you all have left your perfect world. You've answered the call. You've selected your mission. You've gone through the birth canal and traveled to Egypt. And you're here in Egypt for a lot of people come to Egypt, as you know, for initiation, for spiritual experiences. And as I told my group, I said, in the ancient world, we're told that to overcome fear, they'd put you in a pool full of crocodiles and have you swim across the other side. We get to go to the Cairo airport, where there's 18,000 people battling for maybe 500 seats on these airplanes. And so here we are. Welcome to it. You know, it's not like they were doing it in the ancient world. This is how we do it today. We're going to throw you out here in the middle of these crocodiles, cut your phone, cut your internet. You're not going to know which way if you're coming or going. So what are you going to do?
But it's so astute of you, really, because, yes, I also tell people just getting to Egypt is your first initiation.
Exactly.
How many people report that they tried 3-4 times, usually 3 is the number, and it was the third time they finally managed to get to Egypt? And it's just so true that process in itself is the initiation. And I'm quite sure that nobody wanted to be initiated stuck inside a hotel when the pyramid was right there, so close,
right, exactly,
and yet so far away.
Yeah, and that's what I was doing on the Facebook page, too, was just trying to say, oh, you know, we're sitting here, the pyramids are over here, it's a sunny day. And I was really just trying to paint a picture for people at home that, really, we're okay. But while we're sitting there in front of the pyramids, we are thinking, what have we gotten ourselves into? How are we going to get out of here? Are we going to get out of here?
And really? Because you definitely didn't portray that in your messages.
No, I was just trying to keep everybody kind of positive at home. And when I could talk with my family on the phone, I would just beg them, please, don't watch the television. Because the media loves events like this. They love to blow it all out of proportion. It helps them sell more ads for hamburgers and vodka or whatever it is they're selling. And but you know you're in trouble when Anderson Cooper is doing his show right out in front of your hotel. Because when he goes to hot spots, it's like, uh-oh. Okay, I've seen him in Haiti. I've seen him in all these other places. And there he is out in front of our hotel.
You've got to hand it to Anderson Cooper. He does have a courageous spirit in journalism.
I was thinking about that. I mean, just how much guts it really does take. An organization, CNN, he must have a real powerful staff behind him that gets him into these places and out. Just the logistics and just everything about it is a challenge.
See, Meridian is the hotel where I always stay in Egypt. I know all the staff there, and they're great people there. So my question to you is, was everybody hunkered down? Was the staff hunkered down as well?
The staff was hunkered down. In fact, they brought their families in to stay at the hotel, and they were so impressive. They were impeccable. I mean, they were absolute stars. In the face of this, they were the ones saying to us, calm down, it's going to be okay, it's going to be okay. And what we did in return with them is to say, well, yeah, well, you guys got to keep going. You got to keep pushing through this. Your fight for freedom is worth it. And so it became kind of a really nice reciprocal relationship. But the staff, Mr. Newby, the manager there, and all his people were calm. They maintained their professionalism, their impeccable service, everything. You hardly wouldn't know that outside the hotel were parked a bunch of tanks unless you saw the staff there taking lunches out to the military guys.
So what did you actually observe when you said you heard gunshots? This was now the second day that you were at the hotel, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, at night.
What were you doing? Were you hiding out in the lobby? How were you handling it?
Yeah, we were mostly, we'd hang out in the lobby. My wife and I especially were trying to be very conscious and aware that our people needed to see us at all times. So we spent most of our time in the lobby where anybody could ask questions or borrow my cell phone or whatever it was they needed to do. And then outside, by the pool, they had some TVs that were set up in a little outdoor seating area. And we'd be out there watching Al Jazeera with some of the other guests from around the world. And it would be in those times when you would hear gunfire just over the wall, the other side of the wall outside the hotel.
All right.
Automatic gunfire.
Four nights you were there, right?
Three or four nights, yeah.
Okay. Tell us about the trek, which had to be frightening, to the airport, as most people may not know that it's a very long drive, actually, on a good day, but let's say on a regular day, it could be over an hour and 15 hour half drive.
Yeah,
but
it's about an hour.
It was 3 hours, 3.5 hours to get to the airport.
Well, it wasn't quite that long, but yeah, normally it is about an hour and a half or so. And again, it was tricky, such a sense of hope because it's like, okay, we finally, after two or three times of making arrangements with the airlines, I mean, we would call and get seats only to find out that the flight had been canceled, and now we have to start all over again and getting people flights. This takes hours to do, because especially when the phone is not working the whole time. So finally that morning, must have been about 20 of us, we're good to go. We've got a flight at about 1 o'clock. Actually, my BA flight was supposed to leave around 3. It left at 11 a.m., but everybody else was leaving around 1 o'clock. Because of the curfew, you can't leave your hotel before 8 a.m., but that also means that any coach that's coming to pick you up can't come and get you exactly at 8 because it's going to take them a while to get there. So we spent about 45 minutes to an hour waiting outside for our coach to arrive, and our A&K guys were in touch with him. He had to go through all these checkpoints, these vigilante neighborhood checkpoints. So it was starting to get nervous. Was this guy actually going to be able to make it to us, or were we just going to be standing out here in front of the hotel all day and miss our flights? Fortunately, luckily, the coach turns up. My wife, Claire, my tour facilitator, had completely abandoned us, and my wife stepped up and took her place. And fortunately, she just had this intuitive hit to call the A&K guys the night before to tell them that we've got 20 people instead of what they thought might have been 6 or 7. And it was a good move because they were originally just going to send a small van, which would have been a crazy situation if they pulled up with this small van and expected 20 people to get in it, because not everybody would have gotten to go. And at that point, everybody wanted to get out of there. So here comes our big coach, and we start making the trek, and we're not, I don't know, half a mile out of past the Meridian. We're passing the pyramids area, and here's our first checkpoint. Guys with machetes, baseball bats, makeshift weapons have set up these checkpoints, and they're wanting to board our bus to find out who are you? Who are you coming into our neighborhood? And what started to happen is that the ANK guys and our bus driver really got more aggressive and just telling each of these checkpoints, of which we went through it easily a half a dozen of them, that we were okay, that we could pass through, and they started to let us through. But on the way, we're just roving bands of people with any kind of weapon you can imagine in their hands except for guns. And you see incredible just filth, devastation. There have been fires all over the place, passed two dead horses in the streets, which was kind of heartbreaking. And it was like you could tell that all hell had broken loose in these neighborhoods around Giza. And then finally, we make it to the ring road to the on the highway there towards the airport. You go through a couple of tank checkpoints, and then finally you get to the airport, and here's this huge traffic jam with a military checkpoint outside the airport. So the whole time, it's like we're just wondering, are we going to be able to make our flights? What's going to happen at the airport? And when we finally did get up to the airport, there were thousands of people. It was mayhem in Terminal 1 trying to catch these BA flights. And literally, it was like kung fu fighting, hand-to-hand combat, getting through this security. Our ANK guys were like a couple of fullbacks just blocking for us. And I personally watched two babies in carriages being pushed by their parents getting crushed by the crowd. It was mayhem.
We didn't really get the impression that it was as bad as you're telling us, at least not from the media that I watched. But yeah, we did see that the airport was one of the worst alternatives when all those people were in there. How did you get in there? How did you get through in time to get on those flights?
We didn't. The BA flight left without us. And that was really a letdown. I mean, that was just awful because My wife is British, and she has a friend at the British Embassy in Cairo who had been checking the computer every day, watching those BA flights, British Airways flights, very closely, and they left every day between 3 and 4 p.m., and so she kept telling us, the embassy person did, just get to the airport, the plane won't leave till 3 p.m. at the earliest. Our flight left at 11, but the thing was is that I had, a couple of days before, bought a couple of backup seats on another airline, and we were able to make the run over to the other terminal and catch these other flights out. The rest of our group, most of them were, we had some on a Lufthansa flight. They got out okay. There was a group on a Delta flight, a Delta rescue flight, a 767, seats 250 passengers. It left with 40 people on it.
Why?
Because apparently they just couldn't get their act together. It was such chaos and mayhem at the airport that they just finally, I guess they decided on a takeoff time, and if anybody was on the plane at that time, they left. If not, catch you another time.
So you separated from your group and caught your flight and didn't really know what was happening with all the people?
No, we knew, we saw them with their boarding passes in their hands and headed to their gates. So we felt that okay, they're gonna be set. They're through the gauntlet now. If they can just get on the flight, they'll be okay. And the ANK guys were there to help them do that. And that's when we left and went over to the other terminal.
Did you cry when you finally got out?
Oh, it was ecstasy. It really was. When the plane lifted off from Cairo, everybody just erupted into applause. Everybody had a story. A lot of the people were Brits that were working in Cairo that were being evacuated by their companies. Everybody just had this sense of relief. We sat on the tarmac for about 3 hours before the plane lifted off, so it was kind of like, yet again, sitting there wondering, okay, so we're on the plane. Are they going to take us off the plane? Are we going to go back in? Are they going to take off? Because the curfew was coming. And no planes were allowed to land or take off during the curfew.
Boy, what a harrowing experience. What do you take
my
away from this?
My hair turned gray before my eyes. I'm not kidding. I looked in the mirror about the third morning. I'm like, oh, my God.
Well, I'm not pleased to understand that my laughter is certainly...
No, I can laugh about it now. I mean, it's like when you look back, it's like, that wasn't so bad. But during the middle of it, it was really kind of trying. I mean, and you know, you just went through it all, and these folks that were on our tour were just fantastic. I mean, they kept their spirits up. They hung together. They kept their attitude in the right place, and it was just wow.
Well, as a spiritual leader of this group, were you able to do any of your... I mean, obviously, there was so much going on. It wasn't exactly the time to be doing meditation and things, but what were you able to bring through the experience for the group?
Well, the main thing was just that we are here to experience this, and we've got to just keep focused on what is on the other side, keep focused on the victory. And in fact, that became the chant for the group. I gave everybody three power words to meditate and focus on, especially as we were headed towards the airport. And those words were, yes. What do we want? We want people to say yes to us. Yes, you can get on the plane. Yes, you're going home. The second word is love. We love everybody, and everybody loves us. And the third word was victory. So that became our mantra. Yes, love, victory. Yes, love, victory. And so we just kept focused on that, and that, I think, really helped see us through as much as anything.
Indeed. William, you obviously have, I'm sure you have followed the situation since you've been gone, since back. Are you there?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm certain that you've now followed the situation since you've been back, right?
Right.
Given that you had that inside information to the British intelligence guy, which clearly he was, how do you interpret what's coming down? I realize it's conjecture, so we're not asking you for facts, but
yeah,
what is your impression?
Well, let me just say this. I feel something that surprised me about Egypt. I'd been there a year ago, January, and I was very impressed, first of all, with the enormous investment the Egyptians are making in tourist facilities, new roads, fancy entrances to temples. They're really trying to polish the pearl of Egypt, as I like to say. But then something that bothered me was these orders from Zahi Hawass saying, no more meditation in the temples, no holding hands in the temples, no chanting, no talking in the temples. And I'm thinking, oh, you really are afraid of people connecting with the energy here, aren't you? Things are really starting to heat up here energetically, and somebody's really nervous about that. And
yeah.
So when I'm looking at that, and then all of a sudden this happens, and I'm thinking, oh, is the intention here to make Egypt toxic so that no right-minded tourist would dare come to Egypt for the next 50 years or so. I hope that's not the agenda, but from what I saw and experienced on the ground, I just have to ask that question. If they're trying to turn Cairo into the new Baghdad, it doesn't look like it's going to go that way right now, and my hope that it doesn't, but still, I mean, I was kind of surprised by that. I mean, when you look at kind of the big picture of what people feel is coming along for 2012, and you have to believe that the Giza pyramids are going to play a central role in that, and people will want to be in that area. But then at the same time, you've got this chaos that's ruling there that's going to keep a lot of people from thinking twice about going there.
What do you mean that you can't hold hands, you can't chant? How was that? Last time I was there last year, I felt the tension from the guards, but there was no outright saying you couldn't chant.
Yeah. I my guide who worked with ANK threatened me. He said, if you can't talk with a group, you can't do any of this, because if you do, I'm told that my license will be revoked by the Egyptian antiquities people and the tourist people. They told me a story. There's another spiritual guide that works for a big company there who was fined 20,000 Egyptian pounds for allowing his group to meditate in the temples. So these are the things that I'm picking up, and It's actually the guides that are the enforcers here, because they're begging us. It's like, look, if you do this and we get caught, I'm going to be in really big trouble. And I just wonder, well, what's behind all of that? I mean, of course, you can go in there and you can buy private time, as many tour groups do, and essentially I believe you can probably do anything you want, but during the public times, they put up signs now that forbid talking in the temples by guides. Yeah. And it's just, it was like, wait a minute.
Forbid talking?
Yeah, yeah. My guide and our facilitator got in an argument at Hatshepsut's temple at Deir el-Bahari, because the signs said no talking by guides. And they're like, we were like, well, that's ridiculous. What are we supposed to do, just bring everybody here and point at stuff? And it's, you just wonder, well, where's this coming from? And the only answer that I have is that they're trying to put up maybe a lockdown on these temples. I think they're getting really ready to become even more energetically active than they were perhaps in recent memory. And they perhaps have a sense of that and are trying to, I don't know, just keep a lid on everything there.
Yes, that's my opinion. And we've certainly been doing a lot of work energizing these temples for so many years. So many spiritual people have been working with these energies. And then, of course, the planet, the energies that are now coming into play, it makes total sense. I have, last year when I was there, I was chagrined when I went to my beloved Abydos.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this concrete. Did you go to Abydos?
Yes.
So that concrete abortion of a building that was pointing right at the temple for a snack bar and whatever they're doing there, breaking the sacred energy of this holy, holy place.
Exactly.
I actually broke down in tears then and thought, is this the last time I'm coming to Egypt?
I know it. I know. You get that. It's like it's the Disneyfication of Egypt. And some of it is good, but like that abortion, as you're saying, at Abydos, is absolutely appalling.
Well, it's a pointed, it's like a penis. It's pointed right at this big concrete straight building, pointed right at the temple, breaking the energy, or attempting to at least.
Yep, exactly. So I think that is in play here. And you just wonder, I mean, think about it, Patricia, those temples have been just working for how many, couple of decades, let's say, and now all of a sudden there's no tourists in Egypt. The temples presumably then are empty. And you wonder, well, okay, maybe it's good for the temples to get a little bit of a break right now. Maybe the empty vessels will fill back up. It's just kind of intriguing to think about the impact on the temples of this situation.
Oh, boy. These are interesting times we live in.
Yes, they are. But I highly encourage people, if they can and have a desire to, that once things settle down just a little bit, we need to keep going back to Egypt. I think that's the answer. And our presence is called there, and it's also required there. So
yes.
I look forward to going back at the soonest possible moment.
I like to say that, too, because when I broke down in tears at Abydos, my poor group were looking at me like, why is Patricia, having not seen Abydos before that, they have no idea other than my book of what simple eloquence this place was.
Exactly. And by the way, Patricia, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, when we got there, we saw this abortion of cement in that garden. I really wondered if I would ever go back again.
I know.
But a few of my people said, Patricia, and Stephen Mailer is another one, said, Patricia, we have to keep going back. We have to keep Egypt alive.
Yes.
And we have to keep the temples alive.
We do, exactly. And on that, one of the highlights for me of the tours always is to go to the Osirion and climb down the stairs and see is the Osirion going to be dry or is it going to be filled with water? Big question, always wondering. And we got there this year. It was filled with that green water. And we were informed that it's off limits to tourists now by orders of Zahi Hawass.
You mean to even walk down the stairs?
To walk down the stairs is is no longer allowed by Zahi Hawass.
Well, I bring my groups in for those private accesses that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. So it's the only way that I can cope with all of this stuff.
Yeah.
But people, get to Egypt when things cool down. Get to Egypt, because it really is. It seems to me that this is a place where dark and light is working itself out, and I'm not talking about in the square, but at the temples.
Right.
And that, yeah, I do think that there is a concerted effort to keep people from tapping into those energies. I have a story, which there's not time for now, about being harassed by the guards. That actually, my group heard one of the guards say, "That's Patricia." And they blocked us from entering the temple completely.
Oh, my gosh.
Because they knew that I did ceremony right outside with at the temple. So they knew what I was up to, downloading energy from the statue of Horus. But anyway, what is your hope? What is your outlook for Egypt in these days?
Well, I'm very hopeful. I think that what's fascinating about it, Patricia, is just before I had left, I had an interview with Barbara Handclow, and we were talking about a trends forecaster named Gerald Celente, who had predicted back last December or so that 2011 was going to be about the Facebook revolution, that this younger generation were going to use social networking and the internet to gang together to start bringing down some of these corrupt systems. And just a few weeks later, here it is in Egypt. I mean, in Egypt, literally, they were blaming Facebook for the revolution. That's how pathetic they were about it. And what I see is that these, especially the young people, and even, as I mentioned earlier, that professional class, they have a taste of this power now. And I think it's going to embolden them. It's going to embolden others throughout the Middle East to start pushing back against some of these corrupt dictators and some of these corrupt systems. And that can lead to a really tricky situation geopolitically. But at the same time, you recognize, isn't this what 2012 is supposed to be all about? Isn't this what people have been talking about for a long time now, about this great awakening and people reaching up, questing for freedom and tasting it and saying, okay, we're not going to settle for anything less any longer. So I think that what we're going to see is, I mean, the people haven't left the square as of today. They're still there. And mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if they're there for a good while, because they recognize they're like a big, giant battery in there powering this revolution that they want to start to see spill over throughout the Middle East. And so anybody that's part of that old order, this military-industrial complex that's kept everybody in a war footing, seems to be on notice right now that people around the world aren't going to take it anymore, and there's a huge shift has already begun.
Indeed, and I will close with this message: that just remember that revolution. This is if this is a revolution, it's been a pretty peaceful one.
Yep.
That freedom doesn't come easy. That the old days of our forefathers in the United States had to fight for it, and yep. that in our complacency, we forget that it requires that you earn your freedom. And this is what's happening in Egypt, and hopefully this is the beginning of a revolution for freedom around the world. WilliamHenry.com. I've been speaking with my friend and a fellow spiritual teacher, William Henry. Thank you, William. I know you're a busy man, but I'm very grateful that you found time.
Really,
except
really
for your conversation with the very famous actor.
I'm sorry.
Join us. We really appreciate it. You take care, and congratulations on your new marriage.
Thank you.
And much love to your beautiful wife, Claire.
Thank you so much, Patricia. God bless you.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. All right, everybody. It's been an honor having William. Man. Whoosh, to the people that were in my group who said maybe we should just go ahead, I hope that hearing William spoke makes you understand why I made the decisions that I made, and that you feel good about waiting. And November 11, 2011, we will be inside the pyramid. It's already reserved. We have private time at temples. We will go there As spirit warriors, we will drink the wisdom and the beauty of Egypt once again. Thank you. Next week, Nick Redfern, who has been patient to canceled once on me, I canceled once on him, and he will be with me next week, and we will be talking about his book, which I can't wait to discuss, The NASA Conspiracies. I think this is going to be a red-hot interview. So be sure to tune in and tell your friends to dare to think outside the box of convention and soar with the eagles in the free thought zone. Send you my love. This is Patricia Corey. Nanu, nanu. Signing out.